Greetings and welcome back to OU.org and in www.etshalom.com in our ongoing study of the book of Shmuel Aleph, first book of Samuel. Today we are going to study chapter 13, Perek Yod Gimel. And my name is Yitzchak Etshalom, and it is my pleasure to study this perek with you, a perek, a chapter which includes several fascinating textual challenges, one at the beginning and one at the end, and we will spend a little time talking about them when we get there. And we'll get to one of them right away. If you recall, when we completed the 12th chapter, we had studied about the coronation, or the successful third coronation of Shmuel at Gilgal. That will confuse us a little bit in the middle of this upcoming chapter, but we'll deal with that in its time. And and now we are going to hear about an episode that will take place over this and the next chapter, which is Shaul's war against the Plishtim, against the Philistines, which seems to be, from all of the evidence we have, the reason that he was named to be king in the first place, asked to be king, was so that the king will save us, in the words of the people, from the Plishtim. The text begins in the biographical style of Sefer Melachim, of the Book of Kings, that describes a king's rule, and you'll see this from the beginning of chapter 13 to the end of 14, is presented in this manner. It tells us how old the king was when he became a ruler. In some cases, it tells us who his mother is. It tells us how long he ruled. It tells us about his children, about some of the things he did, and then he dies. And that's what will happen at the end of 14, and the next podcast will deal with why that happens at 14, even though Shaul will not die for a while. Nonetheless, here's how we start. Ben Shana Shaul v'molcho, u'shtei shanim malach al Yisrael. This is a nearly impossible verse to decipher. To say Ben Shana Shaul b'malcho, which literally means Shaul was 1 year old when he ruled, is just something that we can't countenance. The Gemara already deals with this problem, and the Gemara in Masechet Yoma Daf Chafbet indicates Rav Huna's drasha that Shaul, when he became king, was as free of sin like a year-old baby. It's a very nice drasha, but it just doesn't work for the following reason, is that this text is, again, in the style of all the biographical notes that we have of kings. It gives us, and it's for some reason a critical thing within the royal biographies, to tell us how old the king was when he first sat on the throne. And to say that this is a uniquely midrashic or homiletic presentation of his age leaves us wanting, besides which the second half of the verse is also difficult. Ushtei shanim malach al Yisrael. So we will have to, for this text, look towards Rabbi Tanachum HaYerushalmi, a student of the Ramban, who wrote a commentary on Sefer Shmuel, and he made the following observation about it. Parenthetically, it's important to note that in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Tanakh, and one note about the Septuagint, for readers who may be a bit nervous hearing about it, is the Septuagint, or Septuaginta, or Targum HaShivim, was composed chiefly by and for the Jewish community of Alexandria, most of whom did not know Hebrew and wanted to have a translation of the Bible available to them. The Chumash, according to tradition, the first five books, were translated at the behest of Ptolemy Philadelphius II, in the middle of the 3rd century BCE. But subsequent to that, the Alexandrian community commissioned scholars to translate the rest of the Tanakh into Greek, and the Septuagint is an invaluable resource for us, especially in deciphering difficult texts. What does the Septuagint do here? It ignores the text totally and goes straight to Pasuk Bet. So it won't help us in this case, but it does demonstrate that the difficulty of the text existed as far back as the 3rd century BCE. So Rabbi Tanachum HaYerushalmi makes the following suggestion, and it dovetails with something that we spoke about in our study of chapter 5 when we discussed Kri Uchtiv. He says as follows. His claim is that we have an evolution of misunderstanding. That originally the text said Ben and had a number. For instance, Ben Shloshim or Ben Esrim. It likely was one number for the reason I'll point out. But let's say Shloshim. Ben Shloshim Shanav Mashaub Mocho. He was 30 years old when he ruled. I'm making up the number, but let's assume that. And at some point, some scribe who was copying did not copy the word Shloshim carefully, and it became jumbled, and therefore it was hard to read. And therefore, the next scribe who copied it did not know what to copy. So what did he do? This is Rav Tanchum Yishalmi's approach. He says, what did the next scribe do? He simply left the word out because he didn't know what to copy, but he left the space so that people would know there's a word missing there. We don't know what it is, but there's a word. At some point, a later scribe came along, saw the space, and realized, well, somebody must have made an error in leaving the space, put them together, and you end up with an unintelligible text, Ben Shana Sha'ul B'mocho. So we would have to posit that Sha'ul was a particular age, which we know he was, when he began to rule, and we don't know that age, and we never will know that age. In any case, the text then continues, Ushtei Shanim Malach LeYisrael, that he ruled for 2 years. Now, this is also difficult, unless we put the following caveat in. Without doing too much of spoil, and this will be a little bit of a spoiler alert, later on, in a couple chapters, we're going to find that Shaul is divinely dethroned, although that is only de jure and not de facto. And he continues to operate as a king for quite a long time, while David, who is the rightful king, continues to wander and to run away and to act with his band to defend Jews in other parts of the country. And that goes on for quite a while. He stayed in one place for a year and 4 months. So it's very hard to say that Shaul's entire reign was 2 years, unless we posit that it was 2 years from the time he became king until he was de jure dethroned. In other words, when God stripped him of the kingdom, the kingship. And then for a number of years afterwards, he continued to operate as the de facto king while David was in place. And then once Shaul died, David took over. That is probably the only way that we can solve this conundrum of the years. So we move on with our study of the parak. Vayivchar lo Shaul 3,000 Yisrael. And now we find that Shaul is unlike what we had in Perek Yud Aleph, where it was an ad hoc battle where he assembled a lot of people, 330,000 people, to go to war, and then presumably they went home. Now he assembles 3,000 soldiers, which sounds to be like his standing army. It's a very small army. Vayum Shaul, alpaim b'michmas, 2,000 of them were in michmas, so Yonatan, who we have not heard about before, but Yonatan, who we will later find out is Shaul's son, go with him to Givat Binyamin, Givah. And so now they have an army of 3,000, 1,000 each, evidently, in Michmas and in Har Beit El under Shaul, and another 1,000 with Yonatan in Givat Binyamin. And Shaul sent the rest of the people back. He sent them back home. Now, he sent them back home from where? The timing here is a little bit strange, as we will see. So for right now, we're going to have to ignore the end of the Perek Yud Bet and pretend that we have not been at Gilgal yet and state that Shaul is now returning from the battle at the end of Perek Yud Aleph and has sent everybody else home, all the other soldiers home, and keeps 3,000, and then they go in these directions. Vayach Yonatan et Tziv Plishtim. Yonatan took decisive, proactive action and killed the garrison of the Plishtim, Asher BeGeva. Geva is here a little bit loose because it should be referring to Givah, which are not the same place. Vayishma'u Plishtim. And the Plishtim heard, which means now the Plishtim are aware that the Bnei Israel, who have now got a king, and now they're starting the rebellion, which we anticipated, and now we're going to go after them. Shaul takaba shofar b'chol ha'aretz l'mor yishmu ha'ivrim. And then Shaul went through the land, got the shofar blast to get everybody going and to assemble all of the Ivrim. In other words, the 3,000 were a standing army, but they provoked the Plishtim, and once the Plishtim were provoked, then everybody was just called. Chol Yisrael shamu lemor, hikash Shaul etziv Plishtim. But what did everybody hear? They heard that Shaul, meaning under his orders, killed the Netziv Plishtim. V'gam niv'ash Yisrael by Plishtim. Yisrael has stunk themselves up with the Plishtim. They fouled themselves. In other words, they know that the Plishtim are now going to come after them. Vaitzaku ha'am acharei Shaul ha'Gilgal. So what happened? Loyally, they all went to Shaul, to Gilgal. Now this sounds like it's another trip to Gilgal, but as we will see later on, this seems to be the original visit to Gilgal, and another piece of it, even though it included korbanot and celebration. And now, Plishtim nesfuli lachem Yisrael 30,000 rechev v'6,000 parashim v'yam kachol asher al sfat hayam larov. This is pretty sad. pretty dangerous. The Plishtim gather, and what do they have? They have 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horse riders, so 6,000 cavalry. And the people are kachol asher al sfateyam larov, as many as the sand by the sea, which of course is very painful for us to hear, because that's a description really that we are used to about ourselves. And they came east of Beit Aven, which is near Beit El, and they camped at Michmas. That's where they set up their camp. And Michmas is a real good location from which to hit both north into the Shomron and west into the towards Beit Horon and east down towards Yericho. It's a really an ideal place to be. Michmas, for those of you in Eretz Israel or going to be in Eretz Israel, if you go north out of Yerushalayim on the bypass road, not long after you pass one of the roadblocks, you could see on the right-hand side Muchmas, which is an Arab village, and Malay Michmas, which is ours, and that's the area where Michmas is. And indeed, if you go to Adam, which is the ancient site of Geva, you could stand at Adam and look down, you could see where Mavar Michmas is, and when many of the events in these two chapters took place. A reliable guide, and a Tanakh, and of course a canteen and good hiking boots is always recommended. The Yisrael Ra'u Kitzarlo. So the army saw that they were in trouble. Kinigasa'am, people were tired, were frustrated. So what happened? They hit. The Plishtim are coming in amazing numbers. And here's a small army, even though the other people had assembled. They hid in caves, and they hid behind bushes. That's chvachim. We'll take a look and really see in Perek Yudal if chvachim should be read differently here. Uvaslaim, they hid behind boulders. Uvatsrichim, srichim is bunkers, natural bunkers. We saw at Sriach in Shoftim Perek Tet, when Avimelech came after his own people. Uvabarot, they hid in cisterns. In the meantime, Vivrim Avruat Yarden, play on words, the Ivrim passed over, they crossed over to the Yarden, Eretz Gad v'Gilad, they went to the land of Gad and Gilad, they went to the east bank to run away. Shaul Odenava Gilgal v'cholam chardu acharav. And so Shaul was in Gilgal and everybody was trembling. Now, cholam is a little misleading. Cholam means all the people who were there were terrified. In the meantime, many of them had run away. Vayochal shivat yamim. So he waited 7 days, la'moed asher Shmuel, to the time that Shmuel had told him. Now recall back in Perek Yod when Shmuel had anointed him for the first time. He said, all these signs will happen to you, then go to Gilgal and wait for me for 7 days. So we have to posit that this happened earlier than the coronation at Gilgal that we read about in Perek Yod Bet, which was all festive, and here this event takes place. But that still raises some questions about it. In any case, he waited for the 7 days. The people are getting anxious. Many of the people have run away. The Plishtim are attacking. Shmuel didn't arrive. The 7 days came, and the people were starting to leave him. And Shaul said, give me the Ola and the Shlamim, and he brought the Korban. Now, this may indeed be an alternate take on Perek Yod Bet. The end of Perek Yod Aleph said they went to Gilgal, then they rejoiced, and they brought Korbanot. This may be the background to it. They went to Gilgal, but there was something else besides rejoicing over the king. There was also preparations for war and dread of the Plishtim coming, and Shmuel was not there yet, and he brought the Korban. Murphy's Law, of course. He waited, and the minute that he brought the Korban, what happened? Shmuel showed up. And this is a scene that we will see repeated in Perek Tetvav. Shaul comes out to greet Shmuel as if nothing bad has happened. And Shmuel says, what did you do? And Shaul immediately understands that bringing the offering before Shmuel came against Shmuel's instructions was wrong. Shaul doesn't say, as he will later, why, everything's fine. He understands something's wrong, and he says, "Ki ra'iti ki nafatz ha'am mi'alai." I saw people were leaving. You didn't come on time. Uflishtim nasafim michmas, and the plishtim were coming to michmas. Va'umar, and so I said, we'll talk about this word in a minute. Atay yadu flishtim elai. The plishtim are going to come. Hagilgal. Fnei lo chiliti, and I have not yet prayed to God. Va'et apak va'leha'ola. I restrained myself. Evidently what he means here, and there's several commentaries that go in opposite directions on this, but it may mean I restrained myself this long, but then I couldn't restrain myself any longer. And I brought up the Korban. In other words, Shaul is giving an explanation, or more properly really an excuse, as to why he brought the Korban against Shmuel's instructions before Shmuel came. And he said basically, it was other people's fault. You didn't come on time. The Plishtim were attacking. I had not yet prayed to God. I had to bring a korban. And this reflects, and for the first time, reflects some of the real deficiencies in Shaul's personality. One of them is an unwillingness to take responsibility for his own failings, which we will see in a much larger sense in Perek Tetvav. But we see it already here. The second thing is that Shaul believes in the essential and inherent value of bringing an offering regardless of the moral or religious context, which is a battle fought throughout the first temple period in Tanakh about whether a korban is inherently valuable or it's only valuable with proper thoughts and proper background and proper context and proper acquisition, etc. Shaul seems to believe, I can't go to war without a korban. You're not here, so I got to bring the korban. And that's what he does. Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul niskalta. You have been foolish. Lo shamarta mitzvat Adonai Elohecha asher tzivach. God, you did not fulfill the mitzvah that God commanded you. Meaning, when I told you to wait, that's God's command. God was ready to establish your kingdom forever. This, of course, is very problematic for those who interpret Breshit Mem Tet Yod 49:10 as the phrase that says the scepter shall never leave Judah, and who have to contend with the monarchy of Shaul, not from the from Judah, and who interpret as saying, well, this was a temporary monarchy. There have a big challenge here because Shmuel explicitly says, had you not fouled up, you would have had a dynasty forever. Ve'ata, and now instead, mamachtacha lo takum, your dynasty will not stand. Bikesh Adonai lo ishkil vavo, God wanted a man after his own heart, meaning a man who would obey God. Ve'itzaveh Adonai l'nagid alamo, and God charged him and commanded him to be a nagid over his nation. Hilo shamarta asher tzivcha Adonai. You did not keep that which God commanded you. And therefore, Shaul already hears at this early point in his rule that his dynasty will not happen. He may stay king, but he will not have a house. Now, going back to Pasuk Yod Bet, I mentioned the first word, va'omar. The word, the verb, aleph mem resh, to say, when it does not include a target audience, means to think. In this case, va'omar means I meant to, or I thought. And we have many examples of this, and only when you have a particular target, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe, Vayomer Yoshua Bnei Yisrael, etc., then we understand that this is a vocalization, a verbalization of an idea. But if you do not have that audience, it really means he said to himself, or he thought, or he planned in this case. All right, that in the meantime is the first emotion of Shaul. Vayakom Shmuel Vayal min al-Gilgal Givat Binyamin. So what happened? Shmuel nonetheless went to the site of the war. He went up from Gilgal, which is how we know this is the Gilgal of the Ardain, up to Givat Binyamin. Vayifkod Shaul ta'am nim simim al-Kashay Shmuel Deish. Now all he got is 1/5 of his army. Only 600 men are with him. And he counts them. Shaul v'Yonatan v'no. Now we find that Yonatan is his son. We didn't know that. Va'am an insa imam yoshvim b'geva Binyamin. So the Yonatan and Shaul and the people are in Geva Binyamin. And now we've got the setup. Plishtim with an infinite army, chariots and horse riders in Michmas. And on the next hill, Geva Binyamin, you have 600 men ready, and now we're preparing for war. Vayetzeh Mashchit. A Mashchit in an army camp is the attacking force, the strike force. Vayetzeh Mashchit Machane Plishtim, Shlosha Rashim. Harosh echad yifne al derech Ofrail Eretz Shual, Harosh echad yifne derech Beit Choron, Harosh echad yifne derech Hagvon Ishkaf al Geat Tzvoim Amidbara. So the striking force of the Plishtim went out in three different directions, north, east, and west, to attack Bnei Israel. A good Bible atlas here is indispensable to see the directions they went. In the meantime, we're given a bit of background. Harash lo yimatze b'chol Eretz Yisrael. This is, I believe, the first time that the land is referred to as Eretz Yisrael. V'charash lo yimatze b'chol Eretz Yisrael. There was no forger, there was no smith in Eretz Yisrael, meaning among the Jews. Why? Kamru plishtim pen yasu ivrim cherav ochanit. Because the plishtim were concerned that the Jews would make a sword or a spear. In other words, they did not want to let the Jews have a smith to help them sharpen their farm tools because they were afraid that they would make weapons. So what happened? Vayaducho Yisrael aplishtim. This is not describing what happened now, just describing what would be ongoing up until now. They would have to go down to the Plishtim, Liltosh Ishet Machre Shato, in order for a man to sharpen up his plow, Vet Eto is his pruning hook, Vet Kardumo, now a Kardum in Rabbinic Hebrew is a shovel, but a Kardum in Tanakh seems to be an axe. Reality is that a kardom was a double-sided tool in the times of Tanakh. One side was an axe, explaining the passage in Shoftim Tet, and one of the sides was a shovel. Ulatziva darvan, and to tighten up and strengthen the cattle prod. So they had to go down. They couldn't sharpen their own weapon, their own tools. They had to go down to the police team to have them sharpened. And so now, vaitap tzira fim. Now the word tzira means sharpening. Nobody knows what the word fim is. Not yet. We'll get to it in a minute. And the reason that nobody knows what it is because it shows up nowhere else in Tanakh. It is what we call a hapax legomenon, or a mila yichidait, or a singular word, one that does not show up anywhere else in Tanakh, and therefore, failing context, we don't know what it means. We assume to know what it means from context, and it turns out we're wrong. Vaitap tzira fim, l'machreshot v'laitim, l'shlosh kilshon, shlosh kilshon is a three-pronged plow, u'lakardumim l'atziva darvan. The sharpening, we'll leave Pim alone, for all of these different tools. That's what they had to do. What is the word Pim? So most of the Rishonim, taking a look at the word, said it looks from context like it's a farm implement. And from the word P, they said it must be a farm implement with some sort of a hole, like a mouth. And that's what everybody pretty much believed until about 1904, I believe it was, when people digging in the ruins of the city of Ashkelon, near Ashkelon, where the Philistine city was, found a small coin that said on it in Paleo Hebrew, Pe Yod Mem. And suddenly we realized what a pim was. A pim is a weight. Actually, the proper pronunciation of it is probably payim, because a p evidently means a third, as is evidenced by the verse in Dvarim Chaf Aleph and the verse in Zechariah Yud Gimel, that a p is probably a third, and therefore these weights, which consistently, we found hundreds of pim coins in the meantime, weigh two-thirds of the weight of a shekel, about 7 grams, and a shekel is generally about 11.5 grams, therefore are about two-thirds of the size, so therefore this is a two-thirds weight. And the proper pronunciation probably would be payim. But in any case, that is obvious because a yod was never used in early times as a vowel. A yod was always used as a consonant. And therefore, if it's spelled pe yod mem, it must be payim. And now we know what's the text telling us. The text is telling us how much it cost. It cost a payim, which may have been a lot of money, to get your tools sharpened. In any case, Vayab Yom Mohammed Vilanitzacher Vachanit Biad Kolaam Asheret Shaul Bet Yonatan Timatzele Shaul Yonatan Beno. So on the day that there was a war, nobody had weapons because the Plishtim were right. And by not giving us smiths, we were not able to forge any weapons. And therefore, the only weapons were held by Shaul and Yonatan. Vayetzei Matzav Plishtim O Mavar Michmas. So the camp of the Plishtim went to Mavar Michmas, and that sets the stage for the war that we will see begin in the next parak, in Parak Yud Daled, which is a very significant chapter, and as we will see, will sort of be the end of Sefer Shaul, but sort of not. Everyone should have a wonderful day.